Next matter on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Daniel Scott. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. While you're getting settled, I'll just remind you of our procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal, should you choose to use it. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your arguments, because we are making an audio recording of this session for our records, and that is the only recording that is permitted under our rules. Finally, the podium, you may know you can raise or lower it depending on your needs. There's a button right under the middle of the front. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you are ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherburne County attorney, and I appear on behalf of appellant, the State of Minnesota. This court should reverse the dismissal of charges against Mr. Nelson because the district court's decision rests on two compounding legal errors. First, the district court used an incorrect standard to improperly narrow the meaning of physical control, limiting it to situations where a person is in the driver's seat of a vehicle with the keys and has an affirmative intent to be driving. Second, the district court exceeded its gatekeeping authority at the probable cause stage when it started to weigh the evidence and, instead of construing those facts in the light most favorable to the state, construed or took inferences from those facts in a way that benefited the respondent.
Counsel, were any of the facts in dispute, though?
The facts themselves are not in dispute. However, there are inferences that the district court took from those facts that were weighed against the state improperly at the probable cause stage.
But say the case had just proceeded on a stipulated facts basis without the probable cause determination and presented to this judge, the outcome would have been the same, wouldn't it? Same judge, same facts.
Yes,
it's
however,
just the application of the law to those facts.
Yes, however, at this phase, the judge is not supposed to be determining those facts. The judge is supposed to be reviewing the facts to see if there are fact questions that a jury is supposed to be deciding. There's no indication that the respondent was planning on a stipulated facts trial if this was if his motion was denied. So this properly would have gone to a jury, who then would have had their own opportunity to review these facts.
Do you think this ever would have gone to a jury? I mean, I've watched the tape. Any prudent defense lawyer is going to waive jury in this case, I would think.
My understanding is that there was a plan for the defense if the motion was denied and it did not involve a stipulated facts trial, but that's in speaking with one of my coworkers that was the trial attorney on this case.
But are you aware of any case that's really on point with this, where the passed out person isn't behind the wheel, he's actually in the back seat, asleep, and has to be awakened with some difficulty by the officers? Even from a probable cause standpoint, can you point to a case that says that's good for probable cause?
There is no exact case on point for this, but I'd point the court to its own decision in Moe, where it said that these physical control cases are very fact specific and they aren't really appropriate for a probable cause decision. It is something that should go to a fact finder at a jury trial to decide whether the inferences from the facts that are there are sufficient to prove that he was in physical control. And here, the factors for physical control are whether you are in or near the car, the location of the keys at the scene, whether you own the car, whether you're a passenger or the prior operator. And what we have in this situation is he is in the car. He is the only person that knows where to locate the keys, and it's his car. And he even has a stated intent to be driving, and he's using these substances to get himself ready to drive home. So we've got a lot of public safety concerns here, which is the point behind physical control.
So you're saying that a jury or the district court as fact finder should have made a decision whether this vehicle, without too much difficulty, might again be started and become a source of danger to the operator, to others, or to property. And is that how the case would go forward? With having a jury decide those, basically the elements of physical control?
The jury would have been asked to decide, is there physical control here? Here is the instruction from Sarfield to weigh these factors, and then the jury would get to review those factors that are non-exclusive and could include the defendant's stated intent to drive. Although looking at Sarfield and its note that the legislature had declined to add a affirmative defense for lack of intent to drive. So there are all these factors that go towards physical control. And at this point, the district court is just supposed to be reviewing whether there are facts that a jury could use to find that he was in physical control. Whether there was a different decision down the road by the jury or in a stipulated facts trial, that's one thing. But at this probable cause stage, the appropriate review for the district court was to say, are there facts that a jury could use? I'm not going to weigh those facts myself. And because there are facts touching on the elements in the jury instruction, I'm going to deny this motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause. Additionally,
you cite to Moe, but Moe was a pretty significantly different factual case, isn't it? Isn't this the one where they drove into the lake?
It is, Your Honor, but that's part of the issue with physical control cases. They're all different. You look at Sarfield and Fleck and earlier cases. The through line is if you are with your car and you have the keys and you're intoxicated, that's physical control. That's the common thread through all of these cases. It's not getting down.
Well, but there's also a thread that if you're a passenger in the passenger area, that makes a difference.
But in the district court's analysis, Mr. Nelson was not a passenger. The court recognized that this was his car. He was the owner of the car. And based on the video that was later obtained from the store, he was the person who drove it there. I'd point the court to page 6 of the omnibus order, where the district court said, the fact that defendant drove the vehicle into the parking lot 3.5 hours before his contact, and then went on to say that doesn't imply that he had physical control once law enforcement arrived. So yes, the court properly construed facts to see, yet he was the person that had driven it there, the vehicle was operable, and this was his car. But it then went on to say, because he moved the keys to a place where only he knew where to find them, he then lost physical control of the vehicle. He still had constructive possession of those keys, even though he had moved them 2 or 3 feet away from where he was sitting.
As this outside the car.
Yes, Your Honor, they were outside the car, but you can remain in physical control even if the person is outside the car. So if
that always involves more immediacy than this case does.
However, the Supreme Court said in Sarfield that intoxicated people are unpredictable, and we need to construe physical control broadly to make sure that public safety is addressed.
But on another level, and this comes from having been in a rural area for a long time, it's not unusual for people to be down at the local bar realize they've had too much to drink and get in the back seat of their car and put their keys somewhere out of reach. And you don't see those cases ever charged. It happens all the time. But what you do see is where they get behind the wheel of the car and the keys are either in the ignition or they're right there on the console, as in the one case. And then you see physical control charges. But why do you think you don't see them in a situation like this? Because it happens all the time.
I think that prosecutors have a lot of discretion, and so do law enforcement. So the fact that they're not charging those cases is within that discretion.
But doesn't it also suggest that they realize there might be some issues with proving physical control?
Potentially, but I respectfully don't think that those are present here, because we have those physical control cases where it's a person sleeping in the car have been limited to the facts of, and I do not know how to pronounce the name of the case.
Pasterski?
Yes, thank you, mm-hmm. Your Honor. And subsequent cases have limited the facts of that case to situations where you are asleep in your car in your own driveway. Fleck is a situation where a person was asleep in their car in somebody else's assigned parking lot or parking spot in an apartment complex, and there the person was in physical control because there was a possibility that they would wake up.
But they were behind the driver's or the wheel, weren't they? And the keys were on the console, or am I thinking of another case?
You are not thinking of another case, but there, if the concern here is whether a person could, without too much difficulty, wake up and start the car and become a danger to the public, all Mr. Nelson had to do was retrieve the keys that only he knew where to find them, walk around his car, and start driving. It's not a whole lot of steps. It's not a whole lot that he had to do to turn himself into a public safety concern. And he told the officers that he was planning on driving. So they knew that there was a risk. He had that intent to start driving down the road. And if he hadn't sobered up, if he misjudged his level of sobriety when he woke up, there would have been a public safety concern greater than he was already presenting in the parking lot.
But isn't there a public safety concern if you discourage people from sobering up before they drive?
From sobering up before they drive? No. From finding a different, from, but I think that there are other ways of dealing with that do not put you actually in a car while you're still intoxicated and have the ability to grab the keys, sit down in the driver's seat, and go. You could call a friend, you can call a cab, you can walk. I've lived and worked in rural parts of the state, so I'm aware that there are alternatives even in greater Minnesota. And depending on who you ask, Sherburne County is part of greater Minnesota. So I don't think that sitting in the driver's seat versus the rear seat is a material difference when the factor in the jury instruction is presence in or around the car, in or near the car. It's a factor. It's for the jury to decide if sitting in the back seat is enough of a material difference to say, no, we don't think this is probable cause, that this isn't physical control, not for the judge to decide at a probable cause stage. That's the issue that we're dealing with here. There was a weighing of facts that isn't supposed to happen at probable cause that should be left for either a jury trial down the road, a bench trial, or a stipulated facts trial, but not at probable cause. Did that answer your question, Your Honor?
Sort of.
Okay. Do you have a follow-up for me?
You know I have some issues with it. But You know I have some issues with this whole thing. So.
I understand that.
From a policy standpoint, I don't think we want to discourage people from sobering up before they drive.
And I'm not disagreeing with that policy perspective. The disagreement is about whether what he was doing was fitting in within that policy. And there are other things that he could have done. He was sitting in a Walmart parking lot. He could have sat himself down inside the Walmart to sober up. and he would have been far enough removed from his car that we could no longer say he's in or near the car. There's a lack of there's still physical control. He could have removed himself to a different place.
But what I'm suggesting, counsel, is where's the case that shows him sleeping in the back seat, still asleep, with the keys outside the car? I'm not aware of one.
And I'm not aware of one either, Your Honor. I think that that's why these are fact-specific cases that are not appropriate for a probable cause determination and should instead be a question for the jury to decide if they think that the facts add up to physical control. So based on this, I ask the court to reverse the district court's decision and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Brady Saski, C-Y-S-I-E-W-S-K-I, appearing on behalf of the respondent today, Mr. Daniel Scott Nelson. I'm asking today that you affirm the district court order dismissing all charges for Mr. Daniel Scott Nelson based on probable cause for lack of physical control. As Mr. Kennedy just spoke about, the argument here is whether or not he was in physical control at the time and whether or not the district court acted within their discretion to dismiss for a finding of lack of physical control. Now, the standard for physical control, while is a fact-to-fact scenario, does have some specific factors that can be looked at. First, in Fleck, you have whether or not they were in close proximity to the controls and whether they had the means to operate or move that vehicle.
And isn't that a fact issue? I mean, I looked through all of these cases. I don't see a one that's a probable cause dismissal. There aren't they all? I mean, Fleck, Pazdursky, Starfield, Moe, aren't they all appeals from following convictions?
Most of the cases are following convictions. I do believe, if I remember correctly, Pazdursky was actually an appeal from the court or from a probable cause standpoint.
It was?
I don't recall.
My reading of it was following a conviction.
Okay. And a jury trial, yes.
And while those are all following a conviction, it doesn't change the fact that the jury or the judge can look over what the facts presented and all of the evidence that the state has offered.
Right, but I think we're looking at a different procedural posture here. Following a conviction, that's when the fact finder, either a jury or a court, looks at all the evidence and applies the Starfield factors. Here, the district court is just playing a gatekeeper role to determine whether or not, under the probable cause standard, there are sufficient facts alleged, looking at the facts in light most favorable to the state, to proceed to the fact finder. And that's a very different standard than following a conviction. And all the case law, you know, Pederski, which I think is, you know, very similar. There's also one other case, I think Jones or something like that. It seems factually similar, but the procedural posture is very, very different.
Of course, and while I agree, usually it's dismissed or it's a appeal following a jury conviction or not guilty acquittal. The issue is the state or the state had the opportunity to bring any facts they wanted, and while the judge can look at those facts and make a determination of whether or not those facts provide a probable or reasonable suspicion of those charges, the facts don't support any form of physical control.
But that's a different question than whether or not there's enough to meet the probable cause standard versus beyond reasonable doubt for a conviction. Those are two very, very different standards. The probable cause standard is much, much lower.
And I completely agree with you.
So why isn't that standard met here? That's what I'm struggling with. It seems like that standard, the procedural posture here, is whether or not there's enough information to proceed to allow a fact finder to make that ultimate decision of whether or not there's enough here to find the person guilty.
And I agree. That's up to the district court to, you know, determine whether or not the person should stand trial for this. And the issue is the state's evidence does not point to any element of physical control where...
But what do you mean it doesn't point to any? It seems like there is a lot of evidence. The fact that he was in the car, the fact that he had been driving the car, the fact that the keys are within close proximity of him. Why isn't that enough to show that there's at least a dispute as to whether or not he would, a jury could, or a fact finder could find him in physical control?
Well, first, whether or not he was driving the vehicle is not something that the trial or the district court found in their findings of facts. They did determine that based on, within their conclusion of law, that sure, we'll give you that he was driving the vehicle at some point. The issue is whether or not they can tie the physical control and intoxication at the same time.
Well, when the police found him, he was intoxicated, correct?
Correct. He was intoxicated at that time.
And when they were talking to him, he immediately, with respect to where the keys were, he immediately got out, went under the wheel well, grabbed the keys. Why isn't that enough to show that he could have very easily started the car and drove away, and he also indicated that he had intended on driving, which is, I think, another key difference between the Padzerski case, in which there's no express intent to drive away. He was actually parked in the driveway, just slept in the car to avoid a domestic incident.
Of course, and in Padzerski, it's a situation where he was outside his home. As also indicated on the record here, Mr. Nelson at that time was homeless. While he had a house that he potentially could go to, he hadn't been there in years since all of his legal issues began. And so the officers at that time knew that he had been homeless, living in this parking lot.
Well, they knew he'd been there 2 days earlier because they found him in the same situation.
Correct.
And didn't he express, however, to the police that he was intending to go home to Madison, Minnesota? Again, construing it in the light most favorable to the state, isn't that part of the record available on probable cause?
So there was a very broad statement that he was gearing up, whether or not that was, determined to be an intent to drive or an intent to, prepare himself mentally for that. Even if we look at it in a light most favorable to the state, if his intent was to drive, which they, can argue, then why wouldn't he have just driven upon getting intoxicated once he huffed the air cans? The issue is...
Well, he was passed out. They actually had to, they were pounding on the window to try to wake him up.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean that at some point he could have woken up intoxicated under the influence of controlled substances and driven at that point.
And I agree. At some point, had this played out, had he not been approached by officers and arrested, there's a possibility that that could have happened, but there's a possibility that somebody
And we have to view the evidence in light most favorable to the state, which would assume that possibility. And isn't that the purpose of the statute is to prevent that very incident from happening?
While the statute is taken to be broad, so that way you can prevent that, the state still has to provide physical control. And while the keys are outside the vehicle and he's in the backseat of the vehicle as far as possible from the controls of the vehicle without any means to start that vehicle short of getting out of the vehicle, getting down on his knees and, retrieving the keys and fishing around, it would have been quite
difficult. But he actually did that. He actually showed that this is a different situation in which, left the keys with, let's say, somebody at the Walmart store and said, hey, I'm intoxicated, I'm not willing to drive, but I want to sleep in my car. I don't have anywhere to go. He actually could access, and not only could access, but he actually demonstrated how easily he could access the keys in this case.
And I would actually, for purposes of the probable cause, you can view it in light most favorable to the state. However, I think what you saw in the video shows that he actually was having some difficulty getting it. It was 10 to 20 seconds on the ground trying to reach up, retrieve the keys, and that was only after it took quite a bit to wake him up from the back seat of the vehicle.
Right, but doesn't that actually show, and you do argue an alternative fact scenario, but we don't look at that because we look at the facts in light most favorable to the state. The fact that he had trouble getting them seems to fit the purpose of the statute of preventing somebody in that state who still was able to get those keys from driving and getting on the road and potentially hurting himself or somebody else and maybe even killing other people.
Of course, and I hear where you're coming from. However, it still doesn't get past the first portion of the flex standard, which is proximity to the controls, which he was not in. And he was actually in the farthest possible.
Are there any cases that say proximity means you have to actually be within arm's distance?
I don't think there's any cases that say you have to be within arm's distance. I don't think there's any cases that say that the back seat of the vehicle is proximity and control up to the controls either. And I think that's been one of the reasons that the district court did dismiss this is there are no cases on point to support probable cause when somebody is in the back seat of the vehicle. There was not a single case cited by our side or the state in regards to
that. But aren't there cases where you have inoperable vehicles at the side of the road and people found outside of them, and yet there's been enough to at least get to a jury on whether the person was in physical control of the vehicle?
And there are cases, and I think the state cited some of those cases, and the issue there is the location of the keys then, because in almost every case, you have the keys either in the ignition, in the center console, or on the person of.
But and doesn't that kind of prove the point of these are all fact-specific cases, right? And that we've also have the direction from our Supreme Court in Starfield to, you know, give the broadest possible effect to the term physical control. So I keep coming back to why shouldn't this be given to the finder of fact to make this decision? What are the unique circumstances of this case that should compel us to affirm the determination that this doesn't even meet a probable cause standard?
And I think the unique facts are there's been no evidence that he had the keys on him at any point. And while, you know, we can look at it in the light most favorable, the state just has failed to prove anything on here besides the evidence of, great, he was found in the vehicle, passed out, in the back seat, farthest from, you know, the controls.
But closest to where he had put the key for safekeeping.
Where the keys were found. I mean, you can, you know, there was never any proving that he was actually the one who put the keys there. Somebody could have put the keys there and told
him. But again, this is probable cause.
Of course.
We assume that he was the one who drove in 3 hours before the police, or it was reported that he was sleeping in the car. We have to assume all of that in favor of the state.
Of course. And regardless, even if he did put the keys there, he didn't have access to the keys while he was in the vehicle. And had he been seen getting out of the vehicle, grabbing the keys, then great. Then they have their physical control standard. But at the time that he was found, he did not have access to the keys. He did not have the means to move that vehicle unless he grabbed the keys. And there was no showing of intent that he intended to, other than a very broad statement, but even that is weak at best. And then when you look at all of the case law that the state's brought and all the case law that I've brought, there's nothing indicating any situation like this where physical control has ever been found.
And I have a question for you, Counsel. You had mentioned at the end of your brief that you request that this be a presidential opinion. We certainly appreciate you expressing that. If we were to agree with the state, would you still want a presidential opinion?
I think the issue is this is an unheard of situation here, and while I think that it would hurt, you know, any sort of criminal defense attorney moving forward, the issue is it would also set out a boundary of, great, you know what, if every single prosecutor wanted to try to prosecute a case like this, they can try, but as Judge Kirk had already mentioned, this is unheard of, and do you really think that a jury or a judge on a stipulated fact matter would find this to be, you know, a guilty, you know, verdict?
I think, and perhaps why that it is unheard of, because case like this goes to a jury and the state doesn't prevail, and so there is no appeal and they're done. I mean, isn't that one reason why this could be an unheard of situation?
Of course. It could also be a situation where, you know, it never gets charged out. But we don't know, and the issue is there's never been any sort of case like this, and I think it's, you know, whether you rule in my favor or the state's, it would at least set a boundary of you can find physical control at least on a probable cause level. However, I think that would be really expanding the broad stroke of physical control to a point where somebody within their, you know, own home could drink and have the keys on a keychain. And you know what? If they go and step in their vehicle or in their garage, somebody could say, well, you were in physical control because you were near your vehicle and you had access to your keys. And I think the district court ruled correctly on this because of the fact that none of the facts support physical control to an extent that a jury should be, you know, having this in front of them. Additionally, I just wanted to address Moe just because while Moe was a probable cause issue that ended up being remanded back to the district court, the issue there was that there was conflicting testimony, which we don't have here. What happened in this case is the state was able to present any evidence they had, all of the evidence they had, including a vague and obscure Walmart surveillance footage. And despite all of the evidence they had and no conflicting testimony, the district court still found that they didn't meet their burden of showing physical control at a probable cause hearing. And that's the issue, is whether or not they can meet that burden. And the Court of Appeals' job is to review that, obviously de novo, but you must look for a clear error, which I don't see that the district court made by determining that physical control was not shown on any level.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just to correct one statement, according to the district court's findings of fact on page 2, Mr. Nelson told the officers that he himself had hidden the keys in that spot. So this is a situation where we have constructive possession, ongoing constructive possession of those keys, because he was exercising dominion and control. He put them in a place where only he knew where to locate them. And so even though the keys were outside the car and maybe 2 or 3 feet away from where he was sitting, he was the only person exercising constructive possession of those keys, which should have been weighed in favor of a finding of physical control here. And I recognize that there are policy concerns. This is an error-correcting court, as I'm sure this court's aware. Those policy issues are for the legislature and the Supreme Court to decide if this case gets there. But based on the procedural posture of this case at a probable cause stage, where there are conflicting facts, those sorts of decisions about which fact to weigh in favor of physical control or which fact to weigh against physical control should be a question for the ultimate fact finder at a trial, not at the probable cause stage. So for those reasons, we're asking the court to reverse and remand, if there are no questions.
Seeing none, thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.